I don't want to sort of make this like a charisma contest, right? When we think about what makes a great teacher. For me, it's really about how much thought is going into the design of the experience.
One of the books I was recently recommended by a friend and a podcast guest who knows that we like to talk and cover a lot of topics related to not just how learning works, but how can we be better teachers? And in today's workforce, we know that the best managers are leaders, and the best leaders are coaches. And coaching is all about teaching at the end of the day. Teaching is the ability to inspire learning. And for that reason, I decided to take this recommendation up on the book by Jim Lang called Small Teaching, Everyday Lessons from the Science of Learning. Jim is the director of the Center for Teaching Excellence at Assumption College in Massachusetts. He's the author of multiple books, including On Course, A Week-by-Week Guide to Your First Semester of College Teaching, as well as an author of a monthly column in the Chronicle of Higher Education. He has a esteemed background. Jim spends a lot of his time today consulting and speaking at conferences, conventions, and events across the globe, talking to teachers and instructors, helping them to employ more proven strategies and techniques into their instruction. Jaime, that means he makes teachers better.
Cool.
All right, pretty cool. So I think that as managers and leaders in the workforce today, we have a lot we can learn from Jim. So we reached out to Jim and Jim said, hey, we'll talk to you. So here it is. Let's bring it in.
So Jim, I guess maybe just starting off, can you talk to us a little bit about what made your background and what made you write Small Teaching?
Yeah, so my background is actually in English literature, and I have a PhD from Northwestern in that subject. But while I was finishing my time up at Northwestern, I got involved with the Center for Teaching there, Center for Teaching Excellence at Northwestern, the Searle Center. And I became kind of interested in the work they were doing, which was promoting better teaching techniques for the faculty at Northwestern. And I found it actually what most interesting in that work was to learn about how people learn and to discover, you know, what learning scientists had discovered about how the brain works and how human beings learn, and then translating those ideas into teaching recommendations. So when I left Northwestern, which was in 2000, I became a regular faculty member at Assumption University in Massachusetts and spent the next two decades actually as a full-time faculty member and also running a center like the one I had come from, a Center for Teaching Excellence. And during that time, I just sort of, you know, continued to read and think about teaching and learning issues. And in the 2016 is when I published the book called Small Teaching. And in that book, I argue, you know, a lot of times teachers get our kind of, you know, these administrative fiats, you know, we got to do everything differently. We have to, you know, adapt this new program or get this completely revolutionary way to, you know, to teach or change all our courses, all that kind of stuff. And I kind of realized, you know, it doesn't matter which approach you're using. If you pay attention to the small things, it can make a major difference in terms of the kind of experiences that we create for students. So whether you're using something like game-based learning or traditional lecturing, both those kinds of things, they will benefit from knowing a little something about learning and paying attention to like the small everyday choices that teachers are confronted with when they are trying to build their courses. So small teaching really just is got two simple premises. The first is pay attention to those small choices. And the second thing is use learning research in order to make better choices.
Sure, you know, I have, I would show you the whole book here, but it's all marked up, Jim. One of the questions I had is, because you speak a lot on this topic, and what, I guess, when you share your point of view and your research, what surprises teachers most? Like, what, is there a specific strategy or tactic that someone leans back and says, wow, I never even realized that?
Yeah, actually, somebody just asked me this question the other day about like why the chapters of the book are in the order that I put them in. And the reason for that is because the first chapter, which is about retrieval, is exactly that topic. That college and university teachers in particular don't know very much about and actually don't think is important. And so that chapter focuses on how our memories work and how we, what kinds of strategies will help us get information into students' heads. And a lot of higher education faculty, well, that's not important. What I'm trying to do is help students think about deep things and kind of stuff like that. But what we've learned is that you can't really think deeply about things unless you know something about them. And so I think a lot of faculty think, no, I'm going to skip about that kind of how to teach information or core or foundational knowledge. And I'm going to assume that students are getting that somewhere else, or from high school or from other courses. But what we really, really learned is that if you want students to become problem solvers, creative thinkers, they need to have a foundation of knowledge. And so what we've learned from the learning sciences is not that the important thing is not to sort of try to cram information into the heads of students. What's actually important is to help them understand how to get information back out of their heads after they've learned it, after they've been exposed to it. They have to have multiple opportunities to rehearse and recite that information. And what we've learned is that the more times you do that, the better mastery you will get of that knowledge. And so you can see this kind of thing in everyday life. I've always noticed that when I have a student in a course, and then a few weeks the course is over, I'll see that student a few weeks or months later, and if the first time I'll see that student, I'll notice I might struggle with their name. But if I see that student's name and I say their name back to them, then that name gets in my head and I'm able to then be able to remember it the next time, right? So there's lots of these kinds of everyday situations in which you can see this phenomenon at work. And so I do like, so that's why I started with that chapter, because many faculty members don't know about that research. They don't think it's important. And I wanted to kind of hook them in to say, here, this is clear evidence for this. It's easy to apply. And it's something that will benefit your students.
Yeah, the concept of retrieval practice, and especially what you talk about with prediction, predicting the answer to something before you know it, is it seems so powerful. Yet, anytime I try to share that with a manager or an HR leader, in the workforce space, I'm sure you with teachers, there's just still skepticism, right? Definitely. How do you overcome that?
Well, there's a lot of reasons people don't like that. prediction and retrieval actually, work very well together, because prediction is something at the beginning of the learning journey, and retrieval then is something that you would be able to do after with your learner. So I also will talk about this phenomenon also with faculty, and there's definitely pushback about it, because I think that the goal, sometimes people think, well, I've got this information, I've got to get to the learner. And my goal is to focus on how do I get in front of them? But we really know that if I just come to you right now and say, here's some new information or a new theory or a new model, the first thing you're going to do is try to figure out how does it fit with the stuff I already know. You'll try to cram the thing I'm giving to you into your existing mental models. Because as all humans, we're kind of lazy, and if there's an easy way to just learn something and get it into our brains and use it, we'll take that route. So if I come with you something that's going to really change your thinking, there's resistance to that. And so, we all have that. It's not just students. It's not, employees, whatever it might be. That's part of the human brain. It looks for ways to save energy. That's kind of the problem is people want to just think, no, I want to just kind of, I need to give them this information. Well, the information is not going to be, it's not actually going to really people change their thinking unless you figure out first what they're already thinking. And then you can actually tailor the information, the presentation of that information to that person's brain, right? Instead of just sort of having a kind of generic presentation of the information, right? Which some people are going to be like, okay, yeah, sure, I get that. Other people are like, no, I don't believe that, no matter how many times you show it to me. And other people, you know, so that people have all kinds of different reactions. So we have to try to figure out what the learner already knows first, and prediction is the way to get to that. Inviting them to say, okay, tell me, what would you think about this? How would you solve this first? Then I'll tell you some strategies that could help you.
Sure. Yeah. I'm sure you have, through your work and your travel and your experience working with teachers, have a perspective on what makes a great teacher. And I think, you know, for many listeners here, they may be leaders in an HR role, or in they're a manager of a sales force, and they're trying to, you know, again, not just get people trained up, but continuously developing, which I think in today's workforce is so critical. We never stop learning. So I share that as the backdrop to the question of like, what makes a great teacher?
I mean, if you think about what we're trying to do, is we're trying to design learning environments for students or learners, employers, whatever it might be. So to me, that's what I'm trying to look at, is how well are we designing those environments? And, you know, when you look at, if I think about my own experience as a student, right, I had teachers who had all kinds of different styles, right? Like you had the kind of really charismatic teachers, you had very like low key teachers. So what I try not to look at is like the kind of, for example, the presentation style of the teacher, because, you know, that I don't want to sort of make this like a charisma contest, right? When we think about what makes a great teacher. So for me, it's really about how much thought is going into the design of the experience. And so, you know, you can do that using all kinds of different models, right? Like, again, like, you know, inquiry-based learning and problem-based learning and games and traditional lecturing. These things all can be done well, but you really have to think about the design of the experience. So to me, great teachers are people who are thinking about the experience that the learner is going to have, as opposed to just kind of saying, I've got information, I want you to sort of run through the paces on this particular assessment, whatever it might be, is to continually think about, like, what's the learner experiencing? What does the learner need right now? How can I provide encouragement for that person? That kind of thing. So, you know, so I it's me really thinking about people who have really thought about the needs of the learner, the experience of the learner, that kind of thing.
One of the things I wrote down from your book was you said organizations have a mindset.
Yeah, I mean, so mindsets are, you know, instead of thinking about people, for example, in an organization that, you know, people have, we can think about mindsets as being fixed or growth oriented. So a fixed mindset is one which we believe that kind of our talents, our skills are kind of have been given to us at birth, you know, and this is kind of how smart we can be, how good we can be at something. And a growth mindset believes that people can improve, and that we can get better things by practicing them. So it's not like we just have this, you know, little block of talent that we have, and that's far as we're going to go, but to be that people can really improve. And so an organization can really kind of embrace that idea and assume that, you know, a person who came into the organization and had this level of talent doesn't mean that's, you know, they're going to stay at that spot, right? Like if they're trained really well, exposed to new ideas, new situations, given the opportunity to let their creativity flourish, that person might rise to the top, right? If we have that mindset. I always talk to people about this as a writer, I wanted to become a writer when I was like, you know, in eighth grade. But the stuff I look back now, when I was in like from high school, it was terrible. Like, so it's like, I don't feel like I had any special natural talent as a writer. Now, I do think there are some people that are a little bit more gifted in that area than others, but at the same time, when I look at my career, right now, having written 6 or 7 books at this point, and you know, hundreds of articles, and that just happened because of practice and because I cared about it. And I just, there was a lot of, you know, just tens and thousands of pages, which are, you know, buried into my old files. And, you know, so to me, like that's a really, it's a powerful way to think about things. And it's the other option is to think, no, I wasn't given the talent to be a writer. I should do something else, right? And that's really debilitating. And so for both our people and as an organization, we want to have that more growth-oriented mindset.
And, you know, unfortunately, you know, not everybody is lucky enough to have great teachers, right? Depending on, you know, where you are and what your opportunities are, you may not be exposed to an environment where, you know, teachers have a growth mindset, or parents have a growth mindset, or your peers or people around you. I guess, how does your recommendations in small teaching and things you're seeing, how does it change, or what is more, even more important given the different socioeconomic conditions of schools or students or classrooms? How do you think about that?
Well, I mean, on this particular issue, actually, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that are pushing fixed mindsets on to people. I mean, so the sort of testing that we do, like external testing that students encounter in school, which is kind of ranking them, you know, according to like these state or, you know, federal exams. People have this idea of the, like your IQ, that you're locked into that spot for your life. You know, I have 5 kids, 2 of them, the twins, the youngest ones are just finished the college application process. That's another place in which you're kind of, no, you can apply to this school, but not this one because you're not smart to be this one or the other one, right? So, I mean, there's lots and lots of and then actually even in writing, actually, I was just reading this poet, you know, which was saying, you know, if you don't have the fire in you and you weren't born with it, you can't be a writer. And I was just going, oh God, I was slapping my hand against my forehead. This is not what we want to be telling people. And so, you know, there is a lot of pushing. There's a lot of societal pressure actually to accept this idea of keeping us fixed in our sort of the places that we are now. So, and actually a lot of those things really have a major impact on students who are coming from, you know, disadvantaged backgrounds. So, you know, we have to just keep promoting the message, right? That these messages that not only to the students, but to the teachers to recognize, no, you have to recognize that, you know, even that student who is kind of in the back room of the room, who is maybe misbehaving, there is potential there. And I know sometimes, believe me, my wife is a teacher. And so sometimes you get really frustrated and that can, you know, that kid can cause problems 10 months of the year for you. But still, it's possible, right? That if we can use the techniques, if we can offer the kind of encouragement and hope that student might need, it can make a difference, and that they can start to grow in ways that we would never expect. So, the message actually has to go out to not only to the students, in which we should be doing that. We should always be saying to the student, "You're capable of more, right? That's why you're here in school. We're trying to get that more out of you." But also to students, to teachers and parents, to recognize that, you know, the way talk to your students, your children about school makes a difference, right? And don't, you know, not discourage them from going to subjects or trying to do this or that, instead of saying, you know what, give it a try, like see what happens, right? And so it's just a message that we have to keep, you know, trying to promote to everybody, like the students, everybody involved in education, students, parents, and teachers.
And again, I think what you just said is, you know, why it's also so important for managers, C-level executives, you know, folks that are in hiring roles. You know, today just got out of this moment talking about labor challenges and companies finding workers and reskilling workers. I share that because I think having an awareness for the things you're talking about, especially in small teaching and the challenges should better inform managers as to why this is so important for them to consider when they build onboarding programs or they're building continuous development structures. And you know, I know I came out of the book with a handful of tools. I'm like, if I could sprinkle this on this process,
yeah,
you know, whether it's interleaving or spacing, is there anything, if you were to give a manager a piece of advice, you know, there's someone out there that's a first-time manager thinking about how do I onboard my, you know, my new summer class? Any tips for that manager that's trying to figure out how to, you know, teach their people?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is I would just say there really has been an explosion of research and resources about, you know, learning and about how we can help people from kindergarten students all the way through employees, right, and adults. And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff available right now. And so, you know, there's lots of books about learning that are accessible to people outside of education. So, you know, just get a basic familiarity with some of those kinds of things. It really would make a big difference. And like spacing is a great example of that, right? So one thing that we know is it's much better to space your learning out over a longer period of time than it is to cram everything into one learning session, right? It's like that's a clear implication for you, right? So if you're onboarding your employees, don't do like the kind of one day, everything gets thrown at you, and then you're off to start doing your job. It would be much better to do, you know, 8 1-hour sessions than to do that kind of cram exposure, right? So like, you know, to just, and that's an easy way to understand and explain to people and could be used to design in an onboarding experience. So, you know, exposure to like 5 of these ideas immediately will like increase the level of the effectiveness of your training, right? By a little bit of exposure to some of these ideas can make a big difference in terms of the design of a learning experience.
That's great. And I'm sure you talked about that a little bit, and I know your other book, Distracted, on why students can't focus. We need a whole another 30 minutes probably to wrap on that one. I'm excited to read that one.
Yeah, the main there is to kind of think about the fact that no learning happens unless there's attention first, right? So you might think about that as even before the point where we can start thinking about how to expose the learner to new information, the design of that. You got to just people get his attention, right? And you have to think about what gets in the way of attention.
Sure.
And again, too, I think there are very small things and practical things that you can do in learning experiences that, you know, that will, again, will kind of benefit the learner.
Yep. That's great. Jim, last question. Appreciate you taking time. Last question for you. What's your hope for the future of work?
Well, that's a really good question. So I try to think about the one of the things actually I talk about in the end of one of the final chapters of Small Teaching is about the purposefulness of learning, for example. And so how often, you know, students are sitting in courses in which they are learning something and thinking, why do I care about this? Why do I need to know this, right? And one of the things that we know about learning is that students are more likely to engage in the learning process when they recognize that the thing they're learning actually may serve a greater cause, right? And because it's what we call self-transcendence, right? So I can do something just to benefit myself or to do something that helps other people. And so, you know, having work make it very clear to employees, that the work they're doing has the power to improve other people's lives. The more that we can do that, the help we can sort of help work make more meaningful to people, right? And so, you know, I think that's a thing that we can think about. How do we, and there's actually some of this research that shows, for example, students, people who work in like, who do custodial work, for example, when they're reminded of the fact that you actually, the work that you do helps people keep people healthy and safe, right? So to being a janitor or a custodian actually is really important in terms of, you know, helping people working in safe and healthy environments, right? So that's what I would like to see more of, companies do that and find good ways to help employees that the work that you're doing is really making a difference. So I guess that would be the thing that I know, that actually even watching my two older daughters who entered the workforce over the last few years, they're looking for that. They're looking for that meaning in their work. And so I think the more that we can do of that kind of thing, the more it will help people find meaning for their careers.
It's great. Jim, thanks for taking time.
You bet. Thanks.
So in today's future of work, like we mentioned, the best, they just get it when it comes to how they develop their people. They spend significant time investing in their own development and their organization's development and capabilities to get the most out of their people. And that includes making sure that the instruction, the things they're coaching, the things they're teaching, they hit home, they're effective, and they stick. I'll rattle off a few of my big takeaways I have written here. The first was Jim talking about how we need to have companies that remind their people that the work they're doing is making a difference. He also said, great teachers ask themselves what learners need, what's the learner experience, and how can I provide encouragement for that person? He also talked about how being a great teacher means you're always thinking about building a great teaching experience, not just an environment. One of the things we'll close on from Jim's book, growth mindsets within organizations are associated with a wide range of positive, desirable characteristics. He said that companies can have growth mindsets. And we've heard this topic before around growth mindsets. If you haven't read Carol Dweck's book on mindset, it's a must. You should pick it up. But the idea in that book is about people having either a growth mindset or fixed mindset. And Jim talks about the idea that a company, an organization itself, can have a growth mindset. And he points to this research saying that companies with growth mindsets support more collaboration. They encourage innovation and creativity. They support employees when they try new things and take measured risk. They show fewer unethical behaviors and are overall more supportive of their employees. In sum, they found employees thrive in companies that endorse a growth mindset. You know, the mindset of an organization is largely dependent on the mindset and the approach of the leader. The coaches who day in and day out think about not just how to get their people to perform the tasks that they're assigned, but the ones that can think about how they elevate, inspire, excite the people that they work alongside every day. There's a big difference between working for somebody and working with somebody. And the best leaders create the best organizations that get the best out of their people. So thanks to Jim Lang for joining us on the podcast. I enjoyed it. And again, if you haven't, you should pick up Small Teaching, Everyday Lessons from the Science of Learning. And don't forget to subscribe to Bring It In so you never miss an episode. We've got some awesome guests lined up that you're not going to want to miss. Now, back to work.